Good morning. This morning we have Paul sails to Rome, Acts chapter 27, the last story we have in this Sunday school section. So we'll be starting a new Sunday school section pretty soon. Anyway, one important thing to remember about this account is that the ocean, the sea, to us is a nice place to go, take a break, have a vacation. People like to go to the seaside, relax. It's a fun place to be. But, of course, in Paul's day, it was seen very, very differently. The sea was necessary. It was really the best way to move things around. They didn't have trains, and they had roads, but, of course, they didn't have cars. So it was a busy place, lots of ships, but at the same time, it was very unstable, very treacherous. The ships could only move, where the wind was blowing. Just, you can tackle, right, and go maybe not the exact direction as the wind is going, but to some degree you're at the mercy of the wind. And if the wind got strong, if a hurricane descends, a storm comes like we see here, there's nothing you can do sometimes. You just get blown around, and it was hard to know what was coming. This is true also in Scripture. The ocean, the sea, is a dangerous and evil place. In Isaiah, he talks about the tossing sea and the sea that cannot be quiet. Waters toss up mire and dirt. In Isaiah, it's also the emblem of the wicked. In the visions of Daniel, the four beasts come out of the sea. The same thing in Revelation. The beast, the incarnation of evil, comes up out of the sea. And Jesus, of course, rebukes the sea in the same way that he would rebuke a demon. When he was with his disciples. In Revelation 21, Scripture actually says the sea will be no more. And I think there's a figurative imagery there. I'm sure we'll actually have water in heaven, maybe even have an ocean, a sea. But the sea as we know it, or as they knew it, a dangerous and evil place, that, of course, would be no more. No more that danger or that evil. So, when you think of Paul traveling on the ocean or the sea here in the Mediterranean Sea, can emphasize to the kids the danger inherent in that travel. It was pretty common, but it was still really dangerous. And that, of course, reminds us of the danger and treachery of the world in which we live. Just like we've forgotten how dangerous the sea is in our day, we've also, to some degree, covered up the filth and the danger of the world around us. Years ago, people lived very hand in hand, day to day, very much aware of how much danger there was, not only from wild animals, but even from other men, constantly under attack, wars coming, armies coming in and out. You never knew when. Of course, you could go back to the Hundred Years' War, and people constantly killing one another, just constant danger. In America, we've done a good job of hiding human filth, for example. It's not gone. It's still there. But we do a good job of hiding it and ignoring it and forgetting about it. In the same way, we often hide and ignore and forget about the dangers of the world that we live in. Not only the physical dangers, but the spiritual as well. Yet, that danger is still really there, just beneath the surface. However, we don't have to be afraid. We can recognize this truth without worry because we know that Christ is with us throughout our journey. And so that's one of the things we're going to see here is, as Paul sets forth on this dangerous journey that does become very dangerous, Christ is with him every step of the way. God has a plan for Paul. He has something he wants him to do, and God's not going to allow Paul to die or anything bad to happen to him until he completes that. Now, of course, we don't have a mission from God in the same way that Paul did. We haven't been told by God in a vision, I want you to do this or I want you to do that. So we don't necessarily know when the end of our job, our goal, our mission on this earth will come and God will take us home. But we can be confident that God is with us and he will not allow anything to happen to us before that end. So we often, and you're going to see that in this account, the fear of the people, the fear of the soldiers, the fear of the sailors, And that's one thing to take note of, how their fears often lead them to do things they shouldn't do. Very often we sin because we are afraid. That's very often one of the underlying things that causes us to disregard God's word instead of trusting it. And you're going to see that in this account in many different ways as well. And yet, and still, you're going to see Paul, who, although he's on the same journey, facing the same perils, remains steadfast in the face of great danger because he knows that his loving Savior is watching over him. So we want to, when we are afraid of the things of this world and we're afraid of the dangers of this world, know that God is with us. And maybe remind the Sunday school kids that, well, one of the earliest Christian symbols was an anchor, because they did see the world as a sea full of treachery and danger. You never knew when the winds were going to shift, and someplace that was safe and good up to that point all of a sudden becomes very dangerous. Just seemingly out of nowhere, things can happen, and you can be going along thinking everything is good, and then the next day some really bad things can happen. So it's just like a sea. Life is just like a sea in that way. Yet Christ is our anchor who keeps us firm and secure through all the treachery of this life. Another thing to pay attention to in this account is how both the centurion first, but then also the soldiers and also the sailors grow little by little to trust Paul. Near the beginning, they don't trust Paul, and it causes problems. It ends, to some degree, a disaster. Yet at the end of the account, they end up doing what Paul says they should, and it saves their lives. So something to pay attention to is how that trust in Paul grows, which, of course, is not in Paul, but in the Lord that is speaking through Paul. Acts chapter 27. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. So entering a ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, meaning to sail along the coasts of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us, and the next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. When we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy, and he put us on board. So I already made the maps. They are in the office, so you can grab them before Sunday school. I've got three of each kind of map, six big ones, six small ones, and of each of those, three with the lines drawn and three without. So you can look at the ones with the line yourself to see how Paul's trip goes, and then you can give the one without the line to the kids, and they can find the cities and kind of trace Paul's route on their own. So there's just, you know, one of each for each of the teachers. If you want more than one for your kids, then make copies for yourself. And if you want copies of the big one, I can show you how to do that before class. But they're on the table in the office already, so you can take a look at those too. Notice right away in verse 1, we decide that we should set sail to Italy. So Luke is once again with Paul, and with Paul throughout this whole ordeal. He knows firsthand experience what's going on here. He stayed with Paul throughout all. And they're given to a man named Julius, a centurion of the Augustan regiment. A centurion was usually over 100 men. He probably didn't have 100 men with him. He had the rank of centurion, but he is tasked with guarding Paul. So he probably just had a small guard with him, not 100. We don't know for sure, but it seems unlikely that he brought 100 soldiers with him just to guard Paul, although they were guarding other prisoners too. So entering a ship of Adramyttium is a small port in Lycia. So you can find on the map the area of Lycia, and then that will help to understand why Paul and the other prisoners, along with the centurion, switches ships in Myra. So they go from Sidon to Myra on this one ship, and then they switch because the Adramyttium ship would have been almost home. And probably they didn't want to follow it all the way to Adramyttium. They got off maybe one stop before that because it was a bigger port and they were more likely to find a ship going all the way to Italy there. So anyway, they get out in Myra, a city of Lycia. The Adramyttium ship continues home. Notice also that Aristarchus, a Macedonian Thessalonica, is also with them. So Luke is there, Paul is there, as well as Aristarchus. Aristarchus is one of the men who accompanied Paul to Jerusalem. A little background on our story here. Paul is bound and in chains because when he got to Jerusalem, the Jews accused him of bringing Gentiles into the Jewish temple, which was, of course, strictly forbidden in the Old Testament. Now, Paul didn't actually bring Gentiles into the temple. The Jews just assumed that because he had been traveling with them that Paul had, and he had not. But Aristarchus was one of those that had been with him, come from Thessalonica back to Jerusalem, and who the Jews had accused Paul of bringing into the temple when he had actually not. Aristarchus was also with Paul in Ephesus when an angry mob there brought Aristarchus and Gaius into the theater. They were upset with them because the silversmiths were afraid they were going to lose their profits from the sales of the little statues. So Aristarchus, like Luke, is a long-standing companion of Paul and continues with them on the trip here. Notice Julius treated Paul kindly. So Julius already has a rapport with Paul. He already is starting to trust him, and that's going to be important later on. Sailed under the shelter of Cyprus. The winds would have been from the northwest at this time of the year. So they would have been sailing along the east coast to Cyprus to avoid some of the heavier wind and make better headway. And they came to Myra. And there they found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy. So it's a ship from Alexandria in Egypt. Alexandria is not marked on the maps, but it's pretty easy to find for yourself. If you don't know or already know where Alexandria in Egypt is, you can look it up and then you could point out to the kids where the ship had come from. It come from Alexandria and was on its way to Italy. And there was lots of ships coming from Alexandria to Italy. Egypt at the time, and especially Alexandria, was considered the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. Lots of grain got shipped from that area up to Italy. So this was just one of many. But you'll notice that if you're going to ship grain from Alexandria to Italy, you could probably ask the kids, well, where would the ship go? And it's probably just going to cut right across the Mediterranean Sea up to Italy and won't be anywhere near Myra. But, of course, in those days, ships traveled much more slowly. And instead of cutting across the Mediterranean Sea, they would have preferred to stay near the land. This is for a number of reasons. First of all, near the land is safer. If a storm comes up, you can take shelter easily. For another thing, the ships can't take that much cargo with them. And so they need to stop and refresh their water and their food often. If they tried to cut straight across the Mediterranean Sea, it would be much harder to take enough fresh provisions to make it all the way. And also they are probably trading along the way, maybe picking up passengers like they do here and dropping them off in other places so they could make some money that way. So instead of going straight across from Alexandria up to Egypt, you can show the kids how the ship probably sailed along the coast, up Palestine, past Sidon, where Paul and the other prisoners got on the other boat, kind of around along Asia Minor to Myra, and is going to continue its way from there to Italy. Verse 7. When we had sailed slowly many days and arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone. Passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. Now, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss of much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives." Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. So the wind not permitting us to proceed. The wind is from the northwest, and they're trying to sail west. And, you know, in a sailing ship, you can tack against the wind back and forth, but you can't sail directly against the wind. And if the wind is strong enough, even the tacking doesn't really work very well. So they need to stop and wait until the winter has passed, and they have winds that are once again going to the west so that they can sail on to Rome. They made it to Fair Havens, but with difficulty, and that's probably even why they're down in Crete. Most likely they would have preferred to sail, and you can show the kids on the map, they probably would have preferred to sail along Greece and then cut over to Italy without going down to Crete. But if the winds are coming from the west, that would have been very difficult, and so they cut down maybe to Crete for that reason, because they didn't have any other choice. I don't know for sure. Maybe they didn't have another reason for going down to Crete, but it seems likely. It's now dangerous because the fast was already over. So the fast that Paul is talking about there would have been the Jewish holiday of the Day of Atonement, which was the last day of the Jewish year. So it was just the beginning of the new Jewish year. We're talking late September, early October. Is about the time of year when that takes place. So we're probably in early October, mid-October at this point. And this is the beginning of winter there. Now, of course, the winter in the Mediterranean isn't the way we think of it, with lots of snow and ice. But it was dangerous because that was when the storms tended to come, and the winds were contrary, as you see here. Now, Paul had already been shipwrecked three times in his missionary journeys before this point. So Paul had some experience on ships and knew what he was talking about. Of course, the centurion listens to the sailors and the owner and the captain of the ship more than he does Paul. And one can understand why. You know, if I was on the ship and I had a prisoner who was a religious leader and then I have the ship's captain, you know, which one am I more likely to listen to? But later on, everyone is going to regret not listening to Paul, of course. There's some question here as to why Paul says this. Did he receive a vision from God? Was this something that God revealed to him, that the trip was going to be dangerous if they continue? It doesn't seem like it. It seems more like this is just his opinion, his advice. I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster. Paul knows it's not a good time of the year to be sailing, and he's worried about going on. He thinks they should stay there. However, it's not a very safe place for the ship to stay. The owner is worried about the grain and the ship in general, and the centurion is maybe worried about the kind of the comforts of a nicer city. And so they decide to continue on to Phoenix, which is 50 to 60 miles along the coast. So ordinarily, maybe a day or two of travel would have gotten them there. It seemed like just a nice, easy trip. They're hoping they can just get a good wind one day and make it there, and then they can settle down for the winter. But of course, that's not what happens. Verse 13. When the wind blew softly, supposing they had obtained their desire, they put out to sea. They sailed close by Crete. So notice they're waiting around for a good day to sail, and it looks like a good day. The wind is blowing. It's blowing in the right direction. It's just a soft wind, perfect sailing weather. They think, okay, we can make it. But not long after, a tempestuous headwind arose called a Euroclydon. So that's a Greek word for hurricane, basically. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty. When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. And fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands, they struck sail and so were driven. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. On the third day we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. Now when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, all hope that we should be saved was finally given up. So the soft wind very quickly becomes a hurricane force wind. They have no choice. They can't. There's no question of tacking against the wind or going where they want anymore. That wind is just going to drive where the ship where it wants to go. And so the best choice in cases like that is just to let it. Don't try and fight it, or you're going to end up ripping your sails or breaking your rudder or both, or ruining the ship in some other way. You notice they secured the skiff. So often the rowboat or the skiff that was used for many things. One of its uses would have been a lifeboat if the main ship was lost. It was probably also used for fishing, you know, get some fish to help feed the crew when they're out at the sea and different things like that. That was usually towed behind the ship, but in a storm, that's not a good place for it. It could easily be blown up against the main ship and wreck the skiff or the main ship or both. So they pull it in with great difficulty. It's not an easy thing to do, and tie it down to the ship. And then they continue to be driven by the tempest-tossed sea, and they can't fight it, they can't go against it. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, so they couldn't see the sun or stars. Without the sun and stars, they have no way of navigating. Without seeing the sun and stars for many days, they're lost. And once they see the sun and stars, they can navigate again, but if you don't know where you are, you can't really figure out where you're trying to go, right? You can use the sun and stars to know north, south, west, east, but if you don't know how far west you are to begin with, do you go east to get back to Italy, or do you go west? Do you go north down to Africa, or south, or north up to, you know, you can't see the sun and stars for a few days, you're lost. Even if the storm stops, you have no idea where to go. And so it was a really bad situation to be in. You notice they finally gave up. And notice in verse 20, we finally gave up. Even Luke gave up hope. There's nothing left. Even if the storm stops, they're thinking, we have no idea where we are. We have no idea where to go. We're doomed. So everyone given up hope. And, you know, how often don't we in our lives have the same attitude? It just looks hopeless to us, and we think, there is no hope. There's no point. There's nothing I can do. We just kind of give up the way that the soldiers and the sailors and Luke kind of did here. But we should know better. We should know that even if we're lost, Christ is with us. God is with us, guiding us. Go back to Him. Go back to His Word. And He will provide what we need and strengthen us and lead us in the way that we need to go. 21. But after long abstinence from food, then Paul stood in the midst of them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me and not sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. And now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you all those who sail with you. Therefore take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told. However, we must run aground on a certain island.'" So Paul stands up and he says, "I told you so." Why is he saying that? This isn't the normal "I told you so," where it doesn't serve any purpose and you do it just because you're annoyed that they didn't listen to you and you want them to know it. That's not what Paul is doing. It's not the "I told you so" that we often get from our spouse, right? Paul starts out with this just to point out to them that he was right before, and his hope is that seeing that he was right before, hopefully they'll listen to him this time. So it's not just a anger or resentment, but he's trying to convince them that he knows what he's talking about and they can trust him and listen to him. Because he wants them to take heart. He wants to them to trust that promise of God that he received, that there will be no loss of life among you. And that's really an amazing thing, that out of 276 people, we're going to see later, not a single one of them died in this shipwreck. So that's something we can go back to, too. However, the ship will be lost. So there will be no loss of life. God has given all of them their life. But the ship will be lost. This is important for another reason, too, and we're going to see that later. It was very important that God made this promise that there would be no loss of life among them. Because without this promise, both the sailors and the soldiers would have done things that would have ended in disaster for Paul. And God is trying to protect Paul and bring him through to Rome, of course. So this may be God's grace here, his gift to Paul, that, "Oh, I'm going to spare the life of all those who are with you." It may have had a purpose. It may be both. We'll talk about that again in a little bit. Now, when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. And they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they took soundings again and found it to be 15 fathoms. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff and let it fall off. So the sailors, so again, part of the problem here isn't just that they got caught in a storm or driven out to sea, but that for many days they didn't see sun or stars, so they don't know where they are. And without knowing where they are, they don't know where the danger lies, do they? They could be drawing near to a shallow place with lots of hidden rocks that could ruin the ship. They don't know. They don't know what's coming. And so it's a very dangerous situation to be in, and that's true for us as well in our life. We don't know what's coming. Danger could be just around that corner at any time. But like these people, we can trust that Christ is in control, and he is going to take care of us, even when we feel lost. So they don't know where they are, they don't know what's coming, but they sense land. And it's good that land was near, but it's also dangerous, because what kind of land is it? Is it rocks? Is it a cliff that the ship is going to get dashed against? They don't know. So they sense land, and those sailors knew when land was close. Even if they couldn't see it, they could smell it. Land, of course, has a different smell than the sea, and when you get close to it, you can kind of smell the wind over grass and trees and flowers, maybe, instead of just open sea. So you can smell it, for one. You can hear it. You can hear waves and the ocean breaking against rocks and breaking against the shore. So they probably could have smelt and or heard it, even though it was night and they couldn't see it. And then to make sure, they take some fathom, or they took soundings, which means basically dropping a knotted rope type thing into the ocean and seeing how far down is the bottom. And it goes from 20 to 15, so yep, that's a good indication land is getting close, but they can't see the land, so they need to stop the boat, because even if there aren't rocks, the boat could easily still get pounded against the shore and break apart, and especially at night, that wouldn't have been good. So they let down 4 anchors to make sure the ship stops before the ocean becomes too shallow for it. And they're going to wait for day, but the sailors are worried, the sailors are afraid, they try to escape with their own life. And so you see there their lack of trust in Paul. Paul promised that they wouldn't die, that there would be no loss of life. They don't trust him, they don't trust the word of God, and so out of fear, they do something they shouldn't do, trying to abandon their fellow, the other passengers on the ship, in an attempt to save their own lives. Paul, however, alerts the centurion to this. It's important that these men stay in the ship. They were the sailors. Without them in the ship, who would bring the ship in to shore the next day? They need to stay for the sake of everyone else on the ship, and also because God had promised that all their lives would be spared together. So it was also the word of God that they needed to stay on the ship. Verse 33, "And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day you have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. Therefore I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from the head of any of you.' And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then they were all encouraged and also took food themselves, and in all were 276 persons on the ship. So when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea." So they had been fasting. This common practice, fasting, to get the gods to listen to you, right? And maybe even Paul and his companions have been fasting and praying. It's something that God tells us to do sometimes in some situations. But now it's not time for prayer anymore. Well, they had been doing that. Now it's time to act. And God had told them it was going to be time to swim to shore pretty soon. They need food. They need strength to do that. So Paul encourages them all to take and eat food to have strength. And you know, it's 276. There are some Bibles that might say simply 76 instead of 276. There's a variant reading there. Most likely it's 276, but in any case, it's a big boat. It's not a small boat. Well, at least by the standards of that day. By the standards of today, 276 is, well, even still, it's not a canoe. It's not a little fishing boat, obviously. It's still a pretty big boat with that many people on board. So that's something to remember, too. This isn't a small boat. 276 persons. So they eat whatever they can, and the rest they throw into the water. What they had already thrown a good deal of the freight overboard, but had kept enough to sustain themselves, enough water and food for them to eat. But now they've eaten what they can. They throw the rest overboard. The lighter the ship is, the farther up the beach it can go, right? The further down it sits in the water, it's going to get stuck further out to sea. They want to run it up onto the shore as far as they can, because then they have to get out and make it the rest of the way by swimming or in a smaller boat or something. So the farther up the shore you can get the ship, the better. So they make it as light as possible. When it was day, they did not recognize the land, but they observed a bay with a beach into which they planned to run the ship if possible. And they let go the anchors and left them in the sea, meanwhile loosing the rudder ropes. And they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern was being broken by the violence of the waves. And the soldiers... Well, okay, we'll stop there. Verse 41. So they tried to run it into the bay, but they got stuck further out than they wanted. They hit a sandbar, right, further out from the beach than they were hoping to get. And they're not really close enough to for everyone to make it to shore. At least they don't think so. They can't just jump off the side of the boat and walk in. They're pretty far away from the shore still. But they've got to do something because the ocean is hitting the back of the boat with enough force that the back of the boat is starting to break apart, and pretty soon the boat is going to be broken, just as Paul said, and you're going to lose the ship. So they got to do something. Verse 42. And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship, and so it was that they all escaped safely to land. So now it's the soldiers' turn. Before, the sailors were reacting in fear instead of trusting God's promise. Now the soldiers are reacting in fear instead of trusting God's promise. The soldiers knew that if any prisoner escaped, they would have to pay the punishment for that prisoner, which might very well mean a death, and a very gruesome death. So rather than risk the prisoners escaping as they were trying to get to shore, the soldiers think it's better to kill the prisoners. Note that even if the soldiers made it to shore and were waiting there when the prisoners swam up, even if they could make sure that the prisoners didn't swim away further down the beach, if one of the prisoners was lost at sea, they would never know for sure if the prisoner escaped or if he drowned. And so the soldiers were in danger of their own life being taken if one of the prisoners didn't make it to shore. So from their perspective, far better just to kill them right there on the boat. Then they didn't have to try and watch them. They didn't have to try and guard them while they were swimming to shore. And they could say honestly that they knew the prisoners had been killed, and there would be no danger to themselves. But once again, they were not trusting Paul's promise, which wasn't from Paul, but which was from God, that not one of those people would die, that they would all be safe and get to shore. And notice the centurion really shows a great, great amount of faith. Maybe his faith was only in Paul at this point. Maybe he had learned enough to really trust the word that Paul spoke as the word coming from God. I don't know. But he would have been trained as a centurion. The thing he would have been told to do would have been to kill the prisoners. That's what the Roman army would have wanted him to do in that situation. To go against that put himself in even greater risk than the soldiers. They were doing what was right according to the government, right? The centurion was going against his training and his orders, and he was doing it on the promise, the word that Paul said that they would all live, they would all make it ashore. But he had learned to trust now. Before, he didn't trust what Paul said over the captain, but now he does, and saves Paul's life because of it. So God really used Julius, the centurion, here in this story. And so they all, as God promised, they all make it safely to land. Notice that in this account, and that's the end of the chapter, by the way, in this account, there is nothing you can point to and say, there, God did a miracle there. It's all very natural for the most part. And if you're not a believer, you could be a part of this story and say, God, that had nothing to do with God. We just got lucky, you know. But it's 276 people and not one of them died. The ship is lost. Everything is lost. They go through great danger, great difficulty, and yet not one of them dies. That's God's hand protecting them. That's God at work. And so we recognize in this account that God does protect us, and he often does it through natural means. We don't, you know, see God's hand. We don't see his power at work, but it's there behind the scenes, and he's arranging things and taking care of things to keep us safe and to bring us through. And sometimes because God uses natural means, we have a tendency to despise it, maybe. You think, well, God didn't do this. I did this. I did this. I got lucky. Something like that. Or we have a tendency to even think, oh, you know, why isn't God watching out for me? And pretend as if God isn't there in our lives. But we can clearly see God in this account taking care of Paul and all the people on that boat. And so in our lives, too, he so often does it through natural means rather than through miracles. So you could probably ask the kids, now think of some time when they were in danger or they lacked what they needed, you know, or something else. And maybe at the time they didn't recognize that it was God taking care of them. But maybe looking back on it, they can see how, oh, yeah, you know, the Lord provided. The Lord kept me safe. The Lord took care of me. I know for myself, I was just talking the other day to somebody about how when my brother Aaron and I were little, we went down to Florida and we saw a crocodile. And we were daring each other to see who could get closest to the crocodile. And Aaron and I were probably, you know, just 5 feet away from that. I mean, five, maybe 10 feet away from that animal. And looking back on it, what a silly and foolish thing to do. That croc, if he was hungry, could have easily grabbed us and pulled us down into the swamp, and there would have been nothing we could have done. So easily could have died in that situation. But the Lord kept us safe, and we. You know, the croc just ignored us, and it wasn't a big deal. But it could have gone a lot worse, too. So maybe the kids can think of a similar situation in their own lives. So the Lord keeps us safe, even through all the difficulties of the journeys of this life. Lord's blessings on your Sunday school lesson. And as always, let me know if there's any questions you have.